This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, what should you put in your green waste bin in San Luis Obispo?
Make sure you put your yard trimmings first and then put your food waste in.
Also, a conversation about the changing wine industry.
We sold more wine with less effort during COVID than we're doing now.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, November 18th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with a look at recycling. Here's KCBX intern Meher Ali.
Hi, I'm Meher Ali with you on Issues and Ideas. I'm a new intern at KCBX. I have a guest with me today from the city of San Luis Obispo. Rochelle Paris is the Solid Waste and Recycling Coordinator at the city's Utilities Department. Rochelle will be talking to us about San Luis Obispo County's anaerobic digester. Welcome, Rochelle. Could you tell us a bit about what you do as the city's Solid Waste and Recycling Coordinator and why you got into this line of work?
Yes, well, thank you first for having me here today. This is a great opportunity for us to just talk more about our program, spread the word about recycling and ways people can reduce waste in the city of San Luis Obispo. A little bit about myself. I was born and raised here in San Luis Obispo County. So I feel like growing up here, spending a lot of time in the outdoors, I have that appreciation of our open space and our rich history of ranch life that makes the city of San Luis Obispo so unique. Went away for college, studied geography and natural resource conservation. And actually, my first job out of college was environmental compliance and public outreach for a recycling company in South Orange County, where I managed solid waste management contracts for multiple jurisdictions in South Orange County.
Okay.
And during that time, we had an exciting project. It was a little over 10 years ago. It was a pilot program, grant funded. The first commercial organic recycling program in the state of California. And so then I got married, had kids, came back to live here on the Central Coast. I have a total of over 15 years now in local government and public education. And I've been with the city of San Luis Obispo as the Solid Waste and Recycling Coordinator for a little over a year now, about a year and a half. And I think my why for why I do the work is kind of grounded in I'm a proud Girl Scout. I'm a Girl Scout leader to my daughter's troop. And our family, we really value those concepts of use resources wisely and what can we do every day to make the world a better place.
Thank you for that. So the city recently hosted its first ever pumpkin smash. What caught my attention about this event was that the compost from this pumpkin smash was then fed into an anaerobic digester that produced biogas that then generated electricity for 600 homes. Can you tell us, firstly, in simple terms, what an anaerobic digester is and what it does?
Yes. So I just want to say that our first ever pumpkin smash was very exciting. It was a program that I wanted to offer for the community during the holidays. There are thousands of pumpkins that are raised just for carving and then tossed. And we have this wonderful program, our organics recycling program throughout the county, where the organic material that goes into your green cart, and that includes grass clippings, your food scraps, expired food. You can also put food soiled paper. So food soiled paper towels or napkins can also go in the green cart. And that's sent to our local anaerobic digestion compost facility that's located near the airport. And it is a large in-vessel. So the material comes in, it gets grinded down, and then it goes into a large digestion facility where it's almost It's anaerobic, so it's broken down without without oxygen. It's okay. Almost like a big belly doing the digestion work. And without any sunlight, without any oxygen, they feed in hot waters. It kind of cooks the material at a very high temperature. Mm-hmm. So that kills any harmful bacteria and spoils. So the byproduct that comes out of it is a natural gas that is created that then goes back into our power grid with PG&E. It creates enough energy to fuel 600 homes. And then the other byproduct is liquid fertilizer and the nutrient-rich compost. And the compost that's generated is then used locally on our farms and wineries and also for our city parks. And then there is a community compost giveaway that they host twice a year, one in the spring and one in the fall, where residents can come and get free compost to use in their backyard.
How much compost is generated?
It fluctuates based on the season. In the springtime, when you've got more green, there's more green coming in. But it is very crucial that we get that brown material. Brown material is the yard trimmings and the wood chips, you know, that brown material, which is rich in carbon, but they also need the nitrogen, which is that green waste from our food. So it is important that we put our food scraps in the green cart. I'm not as sure exactly how much compost is produced. You can go to their website. It's the Compo Gas Facility in SLO. And they also have great virtual tours where they'll walk through and you can see the facility.
Okay. So this facility is called Compo Gas San Luis Obispo, and it opened in 2018. Mm-hmm. What have been some of the benefits of this facility since it opened?
So the benefit would be this is a great example of a local circular economy. So we are able to, with our food scraps and yard trimmings, be able to create natural energy, not from fossil fuels, and then have this wonderful compost that we can put back onto the land. So really, you know, that's the message we want to send, is that it's the one thing we all can do every day to help fight climate change and reduce greenhouse gases is putting our food scraps in the green cart.
Is this a private or a government-owned facility?
It's a private company. It's a Swiss company. And this was actually the first facility that they built in North America, I believe.
But then you're part of the city. So how are you involved in the facility?
So our waste hauler is contracted out with San Luis Garbage. And San Luis Garbage has a contract with Compo Gas Facility. So all the material is collected by San Luis Garbage and then taken to the Compo Gas Facility, all the organic material. Yeah, so San Luis Garbage was a family-owned business that was acquired by Waste Connections years ago.
Okay. The facility takes in about 36,000 tons of waste and it produces enough energy to electrify about 600 homes. Mm-hmm. Is there like a specific area that these homes are located in?
So it's collected from all of the Waste Connection contracted jurisdictions. So Waste Connections is contracted with Morro Bay, Cayucas. They have South County.
And does the facility ever run out of waste?
During this time of year, it starts to slow down. And then once it gets into the spring, it kind of boost back up, but there is a need for more food waste. So that's where our outreach. This is why creating events like the Pumpkin Smash. And if you go to our website, slowcity.org/recycle, we have some new outreach material, some new videos that we partnered with Wise Studios, a local production company, to give some tips and tricks on how to keep your green cart clean. So, and try to encourage people to either refrigerate or freeze their food scraps and place them out on collection day. Because a lot of the reasons why we hear that people are not is that it's gross, it's yucky. Okay. And so how do we mitigate those challenges for people to try to make it something that everyone can do?
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Meher Ali, and my guest is Rochelle Paris, the City of San Luis Obispo's Solid Waste and Recycling Coordinator. What kind of questions do you get from people about what to put in and what not to put in the green bins?
The biggest question I get is dog poop, actually. So, even internally from our staff.
Yeah. Dog poop.
Dog poop is one, and it cannot be. Diapers as well. So we don't want any human or pet waste. The other big one that is very hard for us is any product that is advertised as compostable.
Can you expand on that?
There's just so many different products on the market that we can't vet them or try to tell people that it has to be to this standard for our anaerobic digester to be able to break it down. So we have to just say no to all of them. And that is because the compost is going back onto the land, it's very important that there's no plastics. So some of these compostable items, these utensils, are marketed as compostable, but they still contain a plastic. The other reason our local anaerobic digester cannot collect these materials is that it's broken down. So the material, as it comes in to the digester, it is turned into compost in 2 weeks. So it's a very rapid process. And so those dense compostable plastics, they're not going to break down in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks.
Yeah, which is very hard. We see a lot of companies, a lot of restaurants that want to be sustainable. And so they'll use takeout containers that are compostable. But we do have to say no to all of them for now because of that risk of we don't want plastics being in our compost.
Could you expand a little bit about how we can increase the amount of waste that we contribute towards the green bins?
The biggest complaint that we hear, and I've experienced myself, is maggots, right? So getting maggots in the... And that happens whenever there's a heat wave. So the best trick and feedback that I hear from everybody, I do it as well, is you keep them in a container. You can have like a large plastic container that you pull out when you're cooking food prep. You're putting everything in there, or spoiled food. Close it up. Keep it in your refrigerator or in your freezer. And then on the day of collection, when you put your green card out, you throw it in there. And so that is the best way to make sure that you don't get maggots or any other gross flies and gnats in your green cart. Another idea is just if you do have yard trimmings, is to layer. Make sure you put your yard trimmings first, so, and then put your food waste in. Other people use brown paper bags. You can use a craft bag. But we really, if the paper is not contaminated, we want that paper to go in the recycle bin. You know, you can put food soil paper. So if you get a takeout bag and it's in a brown paper bag and there gets oil and grease on it. Or another great example, actually, is pizza boxes. So pizza boxes, almost always, unless there's a wax paper lining, which you'd want to take that out, put that in the trash. It can't go in the recycle, has to go in the trash, can't go in the compost. But your pizza box that's soiled, as long as it's about, if it's less than 20%, you can put it in your recycle. So if it is clean, you can put it in the recycle. But if it's not, you can put that in the compost. Just make sure you remove any stickers. And another trick is you can tear, most of them have like a perforated line. And you can pull the lid off and put the lid in the recycle. And just that soil contaminated bottom part, you can put that in your green cart. And that's actually another tip, is some people say they save those and they'll put that on the bottom of their green cart to kind of keep it clean on the bottom.
I actually live in like a shared space, which is multifamily home. So the green bin smells.
It smells so bad.
But yeah, like what we do is like we actually have a small steel container next to our sink where we just keep putting the shavings of vegetables and all that. And that goes into the green bin. But when we open that, oh my God. Oh yeah.
Keep the lid closed. Yeah. Keep the lid closed is another tip. And yes, I definitely want to let everybody know that we do offer the kitchen pail for free for all of our residential and multifamily customers.
Okay.
You can either contact us at the Utilities Department for the City of San Luis Obispo. You can contact the Integrated Waste Management Authority, or you can just call San Luis Garbage or Waste Connections your waste hauler provider, and they will deliver it on your next service day. Yeah. It's a kitchen size pail. So you could put that right into your refrigerator if you want to. And it has a nice lid that stays upright. So when you're meal prepping, you can easily scrape everything.
Yeah.
I've got my kids trained to scrape their plates after after eating to go into the kitchen pail.
I think that's such a great idea because I think most of the smell comes from the water, from the liquid.
The liquids.
Thank you for explaining that. I wanted to actually move on to climate action goals. Mm-hmm. So our city plans to achieve carbon net neutrality by 2035. Mm-hmm. When we say carbon net neutrality, mm-hmm. are we talking about reducing greenhouse gas emissions?
So my program, what we oversee is the waste sector of the Climate Action Plan. And within the Climate Action Plan, we have a lead by example plan, which is what we've been currently working on this past year. And that is tracking our municipal generated waste. We are the solid waste and recycling program, and we are under the utilities department for the city of San Luis Obispo. And the Climate Action Plan and Lead by Example Plan is available on our website.
Yeah.
And within that, there's different departments throughout the city that have identified climate pollutants that they generate. And then we have assigned these tasks and these goals for us to reach the carbon neutrality by 2035 as a community. In our Lead by Example Plan, though, our goal is for as municipal operations to achieve that by 2030. And so our goal is diverting organic waste from the landfill. So when I was saying how that's the everyday thing that you can do is put your food scraps in the green cart, that's because when organic material goes to a landfill, it's compacted down, and without oxygen, it creates methane.
Okay.
And so our landfills, they're designed with pipes to trap that methane, and they do produce energy that goes back into our power grid. However, they're not capturing everything.
Mm-hmm.
And recent satellite imagery from NASA last year is showing that across the nation that landfills are reducing methane gas, which is, I think, like 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide,
mm-hmm.
as far as a greenhouse gas, which is contributing to global warming and climate change. So this new data is showing that it's releasing more methane than we even expected. So our goal as a state under Senate Bill 1383, which is the short-lived climate pollutants bill that was passed that requires all of us, so it is the law for us to put our food scraps, businesses, and residents in the green cart. So California is taking that step to divert. Our goal is 75% by next year. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if we're going to meet that, but we're going to keep trying.
So diverting 75% of the green waste into the anaerobic.
For us, it's an anaerobic digester. That's our compost. So, yeah.
And currently, where is it at this point?
So that is where we're still tracking.
Okay.
In order to track that for us, it is through a waste characterization study. So for our lead by example, we've put all these actions in place, and we monitor quarterly. We have been working with our Climate Action Cal Poly College Corps fellows that do quarterly audits of our external and internal green waste and recycling bins. We've been tracking our generation as far as right-sizing our external bins as we increase our diversion, increase our service. That's how we track and monitor solid waste is by weights or volume conversions to weight. But yes, next year we have scheduled a waste characterization to see where we are as far as how much organic material is going into our landfill.
And when was the last time that you checked that?
We did one last year.
And how much was
and
that?
We were around, as a city, this is just looking at our city operations, we were at 30%.
Okay.
So we've got a big job ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just our business activities. When we add in our municipal, like our maintenance activities from all of our parks, that increases up to 60%.
Yeah.
Because we're looking at all of our landscaping and we're adding that into it.
Okay. Are you having another smash event?
So we do plan on making it an annual event.
Okay.
It'll probably be held either the weekend after Halloween. The pumpkins, they start to rot quickly right after Halloween.
But what about the Christmas trees? Are you having something after Christmas?
So after Christmas, you can just put those in the green cart. You can also call San Luis Garbage to do an extra collection.
Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to add that I haven't asked?
So with the holiday season coming up, we just want to encourage everyone to put their holiday trees and holiday greenery in the green cart for composting. And be sure to remove any decorations. And a reminder that we cannot accept flocked trees. So they just need to be plain Christmas trees and greenery. And they do need to be chopped down to 4 feet sizing to be able to fit into the green cart for collection.
Okay. Thank you, Rochelle, for coming in, for giving us your time, and for giving us such useful information about what to do with our green waste. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Rochelle Paris, Solid Waste and Recycling Coordinator for the City of San Luis Obispo, speaking with KCBX intern Meher Ali. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, a conversation about recent changes in the wine industry.
The wine industry is such a large part of our identity here on the Central Coast. We have an estimated 280 wineries in San Luis Obispo County and hundreds more in Monterey and Santa Barbara counties. Much has been written and documented about the very strong headwinds facing the wine industry worldwide. Today we're going to talk about the worldwide challenges and how they are affecting us here on the Central Coast. Our guest is Ash Mehta. Ash and his wife Lisa have been in the retail wine trade for almost 2 decades and own 3 retail wine stores, Taste of the Valley in Pismo Beach, The Alley in Paso Robles, and Wine Sneak in San Luis Obispo. Ash, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Ash, big picture, what's going on with the wine industry worldwide?
The wine industry is kind of in a flux right now. It's basically changing drinking habits. The organizations like The Who is coming out and saying alcohol is bad for you, and everything's affecting that. And there's also an overproduction of wine. And that happened because of COVID. COVID for the wine industry was fabulous. It was fantastic. We sold more wine with less effort during COVID than we're doing now. People didn't have an outlet to go to restaurants. They didn't have an outlet to go on trips. So they would come and buy a case of wine or a mixed case of wine and take it home and enjoy it with dinner. So that caused more and more vineyards to be planted and production to increase. You know what happens.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, everybody jumps on the bandwagon and suddenly you've got too much wine. And what that affected was the price per acreage for vineyards went up, which means costs went up, which means everything went up. So it's just kind of everything kind of came together to affect the industry, and it's worldwide. Argentina is a mess. France, we're getting deals like crazy. Locally, we're starting to see more deals saying, hey, we never saw prices like this from Napa and stuff like that.
So it's overproduction,
period. It's overproduction. It's also changing habits. And I have to say, cannabis has definitely affected our business.
So it's interesting you said that. I've got a friend who has a winery in Washington State, and it's a fairly good-sized winery. And he is saying the same thing that you are, actually. But one of his big concerns was that there's only so many dollars to go around for whether it be alcohol or cannabis, whatever it is. And he said with the advent of all these cocktails and the canned drinks and legalization of pot, he's seeing his business slow down because he thinks there's only so many dollars to go around. Are you feeling the same kind of a thing?
Yeah, but let's face it. Let's use words that are really – To get a buzz, there are lots of options. And if you're drinking canned cocktails, if you're doing cannabis, if you're doing, you know, other drugs, you know, you're doing it to get a buzz.
Right.
So that's where
the money has gone, where, you know, rather than go to your friendly local dealer, now you can go to a cannabis shop and legally buy cannabis.
At reasonable prices as well.
Correct.
Okay.
For the effect.
Okay. So, again, let's just stay international. You travel to Europe. You travel to France. You travel to Spain. You travel to Italy. You go into a small cafe. A glass of red wine is €6 or €7, which is $6 or $7. Mm-hmm. There might be one or two choices on the menu. Are we doing ourselves a favor or a disservice here in this country by what we're doing to wine by putting 6 and 7 and 8 choices and charging what we're charging for a glass of wine?
Well, I believe more choices are good. I mean,
okay,
as an example, you can come into our store at WineSneak and open a glass of any bottle that's priced less than $100. You can open it for a glass. Okay, it could be a glass between $10. Our minimum price for a glass is $10. So it could be $10 to, you know, $50, $60. So we don't sell many of those by the glass. We sell, you know, less expensive wines. But I don't think it's a problem to have more choices on a wine list. And yeah, you're talking about in Europe. In Europe, the wines are $7 and $8 a glass or €7 a glass is because the economics are different. Most vineyards in Italy and France and Spain have been in the family for generations. So more than likely, they're paid off. So there's no mortgage, there's nothing. Due to strict laws and stuff in some of the areas, you have to dry farm. So there's no water expense. And, you know, the families work together and maybe wages aren't that high up there than they are here. And that all contributes to a lower price wine.
Interesting. So you're saying that European wine, now is the same thing holding true in Argentina and Australia and some of these other places?
More so in Europe, but in Argentina obviously too, because the wine industry has been entrenched in Europe for a much longer time than it is in other areas. But yes, it's the land is relatively cheaper, labor is cheaper, you know, and it's been in the family for generations.
Versus our wineries here, even in the Central Coast, probably 25, 30 years old is an old winery here.
Exactly.
And okay.
I mean, we're talking about 100-year-old, you know, generations.
Of farms, yeah, exactly. Farms, yeah. So moving closer to home, obviously it's got to be affecting our local wine industry. I mean, we've got the growers, we've got the producers, we've got the sellers, whether the wholesalers or retailers. What are you seeing? You obviously talk to wholesalers mostly because, in other words, people who are representing the producers. What are they saying to you about what's happening locally?
Before I say anything about that, I'm going to tell you something that I have never seen. We have wineries that we could never touch. The way our license works, we're a wine bar and wine shop. And then there's a restaurant license. So some of the unicorn wineries in Napa only sell to restaurants. Now they're coming to us saying, would you like some of our wine? So if they're doing that, it's a whole different ballgame because we know everyone's feeling the heat.
Okay, so in other words, these super high-end producers in Napa that are charging $300, $400, and $500 a bottle of wine in a restaurant are now coming and saying, we need more distribution.
Exactly.
Okay.
And one of the things that the wholesalers do is they do what's called work with. They bring out, you know, winemakers from wherever and saying, hey, come taste our wines. We're seeing more work with, meaning that winemakers and winery representatives and owners coming from Napa and Monterey to come taste wines with us and hopefully, you know, have them placed at our place.
So I'm going to go down that path for just a minute.
Yeah.
I subscribe to a couple of online retailers, wine retailers. And one of them represents a lot of higher end wines. There's no shortage of $300, $400, $500, $600, $700 bottle wines still for sale. Is this just pretty much, is what's happening in the wine industry pretty much like zapping it? It's the 1 or 2% that are still buying those $300, $400, $500, and $600 bottles of wines.
Of course.
There's still a market for those.
There is. As a matter of fact, the latest, I read a report yesterday saying that the higher end wines are up by 1%.
Really?
On the retail market. But what the wineries in Napa and everywhere else are feeling, the hurt is in their tasting rooms. The traffic is down. But there's no shortage of money. People think it's economics. No, it isn't. There's no shortage of money. I don't believe so. People will buy a bottle of wine for $300, $400, but they won't buy a case of it. They'll buy one or two, whatever, to give as a gift or to drink it themselves.
But again, this is the top 1 or 2% of the people that we're talking about. This is the minority.
These are the guys with the jets at ACI.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio. Ash Mehta, local wine retailer, is speaking with KCBX's Stu Soren about recent changes in the wine industry.
So let's just talk about local. You said it was a supply problem. I've lived here long enough to see lots of food crops removed from land over the last 10 or 15 years. They planted grapes, and now we're seeing the grapes being torn out. Mm-hmm. So it basically, just too many people jumped onto the bandwagon.
Right.
And they're jumping off of the bandwagon.
Right.
So has that driven prices down? Because in other words, if there's that many more grapes, are prices coming down?
Well, it doesn't work that way.
Okay.
Because if you have a quality vineyard, you're not going to increase production on that vineyard because it's going to reduce the quality of the grapes. Okay? To maintain the quality, if you're getting, you know, 2 tons an acre for a grape, some even 1 ton an acre, if you increase it to 5 tons an acre, the quality goes to hell. So, and then the reputation of the vineyard goes to hell and the reputation of the winery goes to hell. So you can't really do that by saying, okay, I'll plant more, or I'll grow more, or I'll water more, you know, to increase production. I won't thin the grapes. It reduces the quality. So that's the problem. And when you're paying such high prices per acre for vineyards, what are you going to do? You have to bite the bullet and wait for better times.
But then the high-end wineries still are maintaining that quality. In other words, they're maintaining the quality of the vineyards. They're maintaining the production. Those are pretty well constants.
They have to.
Okay. But the overplanting is what's created the oversupply.
Correct.
Got it.
And COVID was a big part of that.
You mentioned earlier the corporatization of the wine industry. Is that affecting us here locally?
It's hard to say if it's affecting us locally. I need to bite my tongue by saying it. I think corporatization is bad for the small guy, but this is America. This is the land of opportunity. You can't fault a winery or a vineyard to sell to somebody when they offer you stupid money.
And it's happening in all industries.
Yeah. So the danger is the homogenization of wine. What do you do? When you're a corporation, you've got a CFO, and the CFO is going to say, okay, I need this produced for this much money. So you either cut down on winemakers, maybe you have one winemaker tending to several wines, but most of the time they're still maintaining the quality in the winemakers. But the key to a corporatization of winery is they buy it for the distribution aspect of it. They buy it because there's a name out there already. They buy it so they can take a 200,000 case winery to a 1 million case winery. And the only way to do that is to mass produce that wine. Maybe they keep some premium wines, but they do add to their portfolio lesser expensive wines for what we call broader market, grocery stores, and that kind of stuff.
So are the large corporate wineries doing okay in comparison to the small guy?
Yeah, because they got staying power. The small guy is living, you know, day to day, paycheck to paycheck. You know, they're buying grapes, you know, from a premium vineyard. You're not seeing sales from that for at least 2 years. That's really tough on the small guy.
Again,
and I'm afraid small guys are going to be going away unless something happens.
Again, my friend in Washington State who has the winery, I wasn't aware of the investment that you need to make before that investment starts turning into cash flow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's years.
So, Ash, in terms of the small wineries, are we seeing some wineries go by the wayside?
We are seeing some, yes, but not quite yet. And I don't know what's going to happen, but I can't predict that. But yeah, we are seeing some of them go away. Every time a vineyard is sold, obviously somebody said, you know, I'm done.
Going back to wine sales, are there price points that have not been affected, price per bottle? Or is this just across the board, whether it's a $10 bottle of wine or a $20 bottle of wine or a $30 bottle of wine, the effect is the same?
I can only tell you from my personal experience in our businesses, we're seeing a lower price point on average, for sure. People aren't spending a lot of money. You know, they're doing other things. They're going out. The dollar that they're spending is now divided up between other options. So 75% of our sales at Wine Sneak are import sales because import wines are generally lower priced. I know there's some incredibly high priced wines and, you know, like white Burgundies and stuff, they're very high priced. But for the bulk of the wines that we sell in that 75% category are maybe between $17 and $30, which on a national average is a higher priced wine. National average is like 10 bucks or something like that.
So you mentioned this earlier. You said you're hearing from wholesalers who are now offering wines that have never been offered before. Is the wholesale price of wine coming down to you or virtually to me?
I believe they will be. So we haven't seen it right now, but we're seeing more deals. I just got some wines from Napa that are, you know, I paid more for them last year. So
prices are coming down.
Some are, yes. Some are. And the wholesalers are getting creative too. They're making package deals saying if you buy this, you can get this for this price, that kind of stuff.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio. Ash Mehta, local wine retailer, is speaking with KCBX's Stu Soren about changes in the wine industry.
I'm going to change directions a little bit. Are we making wine too difficult? Are we making wine too complex?
That's a subject that's pretty dear to me. I believe we have lost a certain group, a certain generation, certain whatever of people by making wine too snooty. When you go to a bar and order a Manhattan, you don't sit there and talk about, you know, who made it or how it was made and all that stuff like that. A lot of people just want to have a glass of wine and not be intimidated by, you know, what does it taste like? Well, I don't know. I mean, what do you smell in it? I don't know. That kind of stuff. So yes, I believe that is an aspect that we need to make wine easier to enjoy, not be intimidated.
So quick story. I was just up in the Pacific Northwest a few weeks ago, and I was listening to an ad on the radio. And whether it was a wine bar, I don't remember if it was a wine bar or a winery, but they were doing a blind tasting, and they said, all right, everything's going to be poured into black glasses where you can't see the color of the liquid, and you have to tell us if it's red or it's white. And I'm going, this is craziness. Why are we making wine so difficult?
And you know, that the black glass part of it is good for professionals and stuff like that, you know. But for the average consumer, they don't want to work that hard. And why are we making them work that hard? Pour them a darn glass of wine and let them enjoy it.
Eat, drink what you enjoy.
Right.
So, Ash, as we start wrapping up a little bit here, what do you anticipate for the wine industry, particularly here in our area, for the next couple of years? If you had to put a crystal ball, what does it say?
I think prices are going to be lower. They'll have to be, and people are just going to be not making as much money. That's just the way it is. The good part about wine is that it's been around for thousands of years. So it's not going to go away. It'll be a cycle. It'll come back again. That's what we're all hoping for, actually.
Right.
You know, but I don't know. There has to be something. But, you know, wines that used to be $60 are now $90. And people are revolting. They're saying, no, I'm not going to pay that. And you can see that. The sweet spot to us for wines is around $30 to $40. You know, people have no problem paying $30 for a bottle of wine or $40 for a bottle of wine.
And again, this is a really loaded question. You may not want to answer this, but a $30 or $40 bottle of wine, do you get a better bottle of wine from an import versus from this country because the vineyards are paid for, their cost of production are less, and versus what we're having to pay in this country?
Yeah, it is a loaded question because it's also a matter of taste. You know, European wines taste completely different than domestic wines. But I would say yes, people are opting for import wines, at least in our store. You know, they're coming to our stores and they're excited to experiment, saying, do you have this grape or that grape? So yes, it is because a similar quality, I shouldn't say this, but the similar quality wine can be made less expensive in Europe than it can be here because of the fact that they don't have expenses loaded into it. Now, shipping is another issue. That's where the European wines have gotten a little more expensive. Shipping and the supply chain has gotten ridiculously expensive. I mean, containers have quadrupled in price, you know, to send wine over here. But it's still not enough of a cost to compare domestic to European. Domestic wine's always going to be a little more money.
Are the European producers also looking at price decreases, do you think?
I would think so. Yeah. So I kind of keep track of how much prices have gone up because we have to reorder different vintages and stuff like that. I'm seeing European vintages, you know, go up. I'm talking about in the sweet spot range, you know, around the $30 retail range. Wine might go up $1.75, that kind of stuff. So that's all attributed to shipping.
Okay, but no price decreases yet from the European manufacturers?
No, not really. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the French are pretty proud of their wine industry. They'd rather pour it down the drain than sell it cheap.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So, Ash, to wrap up for our listeners, what advice do you have about wine?
Drink it.
Okay.
Drink it. Enjoy it. Get together. We get together with our neighbors all the time. I'll have a half a glass of wine or something like that sitting outside. We're not drinking cocktails. We're not going into the house and making more cocktails. We want to spend an hour or two of drinking cocktails, and, you know, there goes the day.
Right.
So it's the wine industry is there is a story to it, and we do blind tastings for people who want them. There are some people who want them, and generally speaking, the majority of them are in the industry. They're either wait staff or somebody like that comes in and saying, "Hey, I want to learn about wine," and the we have a sommelier on staff, and he does a blind tasting for them. He does a really good job. So there are some to do that, and we've done other tastings where we make them guess the price of the wine. That's fun.
That is fun.
Yeah.
That is fun. Ash, thank you very much. It's been great having you here today. We appreciate your time.
Of course. Thank you so much.
That was KCBX's Stu Soren and local wine retailer Ash Mehta. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. The Monday Club of San Luis Obispo is marking a century of history, service, and community impact. Since its founding, the women of the club have championed civic engagement, education, and the arts, all from within their iconic building designed by Julia Morgan. KCBX's Alyssa Toledo has more on how the club's centennial pays tribute to its past while looking forward to the next 100 years.
In 1924, Calvin Coolidge was president, the silent film Wings won Best Picture at the Academy Awards, and a carton of eggs cost about a dime. That gives you a sense of how long the Monday Club has been a gathering place for women determined to make a difference in San Luis Obispo County. Throughout its history, the Monday Club has been rooted in the philosophy that emphasized civic responsibility and philanthropy. The group stresses that communities flourish when people come together for a common cause. Current president Don Turner emphasizes that this legacy of service still drives the club today.
Whether it be providing books to children that don't have books, supporting Lumina Alliance, and then we do a Fine Arts Awards. And we've been doing that for 64 years coming up, where high school kids, juniors and seniors compete. And we give cash prizes in classical, jazz, and visual arts. So it's a way to support the arts in the community as well.
The Monday Club was named to reflect the day of the week its members convened. At that time, the small town of San Luis Obispo offered limited forums for women to organize, leading to the formation of this civic organization that met on Mondays. The club's home, a stunning California Mission-style building completed in 1934, was designed by Julia Morgan, known for the Hearst Castle. The building was one of Morgan's final designs before she passed, and she completed it while facing significant health challenges. The club holds historical importance as it showcases Morgan's legacy as California's first licensed female architect and her commitment to creating spaces that empowered and supported women. In 2016, it was added to the National Register of Historic Places, and documentary filmmaker Robin Smith directed a film on the Monday Club's history.
This is the story of the Monday Club and the women who built it.
Julia had a really great sense of what does this building need to do to support women. So Julia Morgan built about 30 women's clubs out of her 700 buildings that she designed. 30 were for the purposes of serving women.
The Monday Club has about 115 active members, representing a range of professional backgrounds, such as retired educators, architects, businesswomen, nurses, and more. Prospective members are required to pay a $50 initiation fee, followed by annual dues of $150. The club's programs focus on educational and cultural opportunities in the county. Turner says that work is as relevant now as it was in 1924. Mary Qualls, a longtime member and chair of the Fine Arts Awards, says the club's arts initiatives have left a lasting mark on local students and families.
Well, our programs are all aligned with our initial original mission, which was to enhance life in San Luis Obispo. And that was in terms of civic issues, education, and culture. So the Fine Arts Awards kind of ticks all those blocks.
For its centennial, the Monday Club recently hosted a 1920s-themed gala, complete with vintage attire, live jazz, and Charleston dance lessons. The celebration included the premiere of Robin Smith's documentary, which captures the club's evolution. As it celebrates 100 years, the Monday Club faces new challenges, especially in preserving its historic building, which requires ongoing maintenance. Turner says being responsible stewards of the building is an important part of ensuring that the club continues for generations to come.
I think any organization that can be vital for 100 years is an important organization. A wonderful organization with like-minded women. And then couple it with this lovely building and the history of this building, that it was founded by women, that we've maintained this building for all these years, is amazing. And people will ask me, friends will go, who owns the building? I said, we do. It's our nonprofit. We do. We maintain this building.
A matching grant from the Miyosi Charitable Trust has provided a boost, doubling individual donations toward the building's preservation. As the Monday Club kicks off its second century, members say they want to expand existing programs and encourage younger generations to get involved. Anyone interested in learning more about the club, supporting its initiatives, or becoming members themselves can visit the MondayClubSLO.org. And for KCBX News, I'm Alyssa Toledo.
If you're interested in learning more about the club, supporting its initiatives, or becoming a member, you can visit themondayclubslo.org. This reporting is made possible by a grant from the Shanbrom Family Foundation. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman.
When I travel on assignment around America, a mandatory way to start the day is breakfast at a local diner. It's a blessing that so many classic diners remain in business and actually do a thriving business catering to locals. The classic Americana diner attracts a fascinating array of denizens, from college kids to cops and firefighters, country club folk, to retired folk who trundle over for a bite from the nearby trailer parks. The local diners are cherished by the locals and often remain unchanged for decades. The Burger Bar in Bristol, Virginia has been a local icon since 1942. Same counter, same stools, same floor tiles, and it's revered today by locals as the last stop for Hank Williams before he died on New Year's Eve in 1952. And of course, its legendary burgers and fries still sends a line out the front door. Oftentimes, the name of a diner itself is a part of the charm and allure, from the Busy Bee Cafe to the classic Horseshoe Cafe serving Bellingham, Washington locals since 1886. The iconic Texas Tavern in downtown Roanoke, Virginia has just three stools inside, but they've been doing a land office business nonstop since 1930. The Budget Cafe on South Higuera Street in San Luis Obispo, California is an iconic mirror of the heart and soul of Americana at its best, as well as a mirror of the unpretentious side of San Luis. Come along and join the owner, Rhonda Maeda, at the Budget Cafe to discover the rest of the story. I'm your host, Tom Glimmer, reporting from the Budget Cafe on South Higuera Street in San Luis Obispo. And we're here with Rhonda Maeta, the owner. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for coming.
Little backstory. I understand you grew up in Reedley, California.
Yes, I did. I grew up in Reedley, California, and I was formerly a teacher over there. And when our kids grew up and my husband retired, we decided to move over here to the coast, and that's how we ended up in Morro Bay.
At some point, you decided you purchased the Budget Cafe. It already existed.
Yes, it was one of these random things that occurred. I was still a little bit too young to retire yet, even though my husband was retired. And I was reading the newspaper back when the newspaper used to have ads in the paper. And so there was an ad in the paper that a restaurant was for sale. And so we decided to call the number and find out what it was all about. And it was all about Budget Cafe.
So you took the leap.
And so I took the leap, yes.
When was that? How long ago?
That was on July 1st, 2002.
The Budget Cafe, to me, is so symbolic. It's kind of Americana in a nutshell. In the 70s, I lived in Canada and British Columbia. And there's a small town and a small town cafe, the Bumblebee Cafe. So many places still have that old classic diner, and this is one of them. And you don't see it promoted, you don't see ads for it. It's like this word of mouth, a little under the radar world.
Yes, one of the things that I tried to do was to economize and save on advertising. And so at the beginning, I would just remind customers if they were happy, then just to tell their friends. And that's how word of mouth started.
And it's still going on.
Yes, it is. I think friends tell their friends and then they keep coming. However, I recently discovered that apparently I'm pretty highly rated on Yelp. And so we're seeing a few more visitors from outside the area that are visiting us now, especially on weekends.
It'd be like a sociological experiment to come here and just delve into the personalities and the people that come here. I mean, you see retired people that obviously live in trailer courts nearby, people from the country club, this cross-section, young people, super old people. Really interesting. You alluded to it's not a trendy place at all.
No, we're not very trendy. We just serve, you know, try to do the best we can, and we serve the best food that we can, given the price points that I have to deal with in purchasing the inventory. We like to pride ourselves in putting out a very high quality product. What's really fun here is the fact that inevitably when somebody walks in here, they may end up running into somebody that they know. And so this is a very wonderful community here at Budget, and we do get quite a large cross-section of people that come through, mostly people from San Luis Obispo.
Talk to us about your food, because again, it's classic Americana in a lot of respects.
At the beginning, you know, I was told by many different people how to do things here because I was brand new at this since I had no experience with American food and cooking, you know, in a restaurant setting. And so one of the things that people told me I should do is said, well, you know, you should get rid of the hash browns, you know, and just do home fries. And I'm looking at him like, well, no, I think people really like their hash browns. And so that's one tradition we've kept up, is that we still serve hash browns as well as home fries. And in the meantime, I kind of tweaked my menu when I first started and decided we needed to have better fruit offerings for people who have different diet styles. And so we try to, you know, tweak the menu to make sure we meet different people's needs as well as trending different dietary standards that are out there right now. So, yeah, we kind of work our menu up, but basically we serve what's popular out there as well.
And you have your daily specials on the whiteboard, and it's interesting how so often there's some of the same items on the daily special.
Yeah. Yeah, we've kind of gotten to a routine with the daily specials, because originally when I first started, I tried to put some daily specials on the whiteboard where, you know, it could possibly appeal to a broader audience. And so I put some Asian specials on there, as well as Mexican specials on the weekend. So they have become very, very popular. And so we make Asian food with rice, as well as Mexican food with tortillas.
So how did cooking come to you? Was your mom a cook? Cook for you guys growing up?
Yeah, I've been cooking my whole life. I'm Chinese, and so I grew up cooking Chinese food, and I've always loved to do that. And my husband was Japanese, and so my mother-in-law taught me a lot of Japanese foods, and I would like to watch cooking shows, and I would learn how to make Italian food, and I had friends who were Mexican who taught me how to make Mexican food, and so I just love to cook.
Talk to us about some of your iconic specials that people come here expecting to find.
Well, lots of times on weekends we sell out our chili verde omelets, you know, because we still make our chili verde from scratch. And so we always warn our customers, well, we put the same amount of peppers in here, but some days it's a little spicier than others because we don't know how the peppers are going to perform, which makes it pretty fun for customers because they're always kind of hoping for a little bit spicy omelet that they're going to get. So that's pretty popular. And then also during the week, I make some Chinese dishes. And so my Shanghai fried rice is very popular. It's fried rice with a whole bunch of vegetables and bacon and ham that's all mixed up in there. And we only cook it to order since I have a very hot grill in the back, and it makes fried rice beautifully. So yeah, those are two very popular items.
You're only open for breakfast and lunch, no dinner, right?
Yes.
And 7 days a week?
7 days a week. We're open from 7 until 2 o'clock.
Did you ever think of doing dinner?
Yeah, when I was a little bit younger, I thought about doing dinner, but I've decided that these school hours work for me just fine in order to keep balance in my life.
When you live in Morro Bay, you're a neighbor of mine.
Yes, I just found that out. Yeah, we bought our house in 2000, and we moved over here, and we just love it. We're happy and happy to be here.
To learn more about your world, you guys have a website? Any online presence?
Yes, we do. Since I'm not that great with technology, I had to hire somebody to make my website and to manage it for me. So that's about all that I can do and commit to.
What do you search for? Budget Cafe?
If you search for Budget Cafe San Luis Obispo, I should pop up, yes. Mm-hmm. Or I think what some of my of town customers say is they just look for best breakfast in San Luis Obispo, and my name pops up.
That's really cool.
And my name is Rhonda Maeda.
Rhonda, thank you so much. This has been wonderful. Again, I love coming here because it's so under the radar, unpretentiousness. Love it. I'm your host, Tom Wilner, reporting from the Budget Cafe on South Higuera Street in San Luis Obispo. We'll see you here.
Been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.